Hello, fellow griever. You have found the Leftover Pieces Suicide Loss Conversations podcast, and I am Melissa, your host. I am with you on this journey because my 21-year-old son, Alex, died by suicide on August 7th of 2016. Since launching this podcast in late 2020, I have followed my heart and expanded the Leftover Pieces to include books and an online community where I host Zoom support groups every week. It is there, in this community, that I lead other parents who have lost a child by suicide from survival toward hope and into healing. The website is also a resource hub, a connecting point for all survivors of suicide loss. You can find me, ways to connect with me, and links to everything that I'm doing in the community on my website, theleftoverpieces.com. Know that I'm always open to suggestions and feedback. And if you know someone that I should connect with to be on the podcast, please let me know that as well. So now, I invite you to join me for real conversations, candid talk on hard topics surrounding the loss of our loved ones by suicide. I talk to other lost survivors, mental health experts, advocates, and on alternate weeks, I offer shorter solo episodes where I go down the rabbit hole to discuss things that have been on my mind or possibly parts of my journey that I feel would be beneficial to share. Every week, we explore the questions that haunt us, seek the courage to uncover the healing tools within us, and offer the comfort of a community that we all need so very much. It's true that our hearts and lives have been shattered, but come along with me, and together, let's choose to find meaning and even happiness amid the leftover pieces before us. Welcome. Hello, fellow griever. Today, you have reached Season 3, Episode 22 of the Leftover Pieces Suicide Loss Conversations podcast, and I'm Melissa, your host. Today, I have a conversation with Kelly Wolf. Kelly is an author, a retired educator, a mom, and a wife. Kelly shares with us today how her 24-year-old son, Chris, died by suicide on July 11th of 2020, and what her life has looked like since then. Kelly and I have a Kansas connection, if you will. She is currently a resident of Colorado, and I'm in Florida, but we were both raised in Kansas. She was born and spent most of her life in the capital of Kansas, Topeka. Kelly talks about how she sat on her couch and avoided feeling anything for the first 6 weeks after the loss of Chris. But then she also shares how she went about leaning into the pain and choosing to move forward and find hope. And she shares with us the unique role that Ellen DeGeneres's Game of Games played in that. She also very bravely and candidly shares how her hope didn't match her husband's. She talks about the guilt and shame and blame game that occurred in her marriage and how they found themselves on extremely different paths headed towards destruction as a family. She also shares about the brave battle and how they came back to a place of locking arms and walking together. Finding their way back, however, she says, was definitely not always pretty. Please stay with us until the very end because Kelly talks about her new fiction novel that is due to come out in a few weeks after the release of this podcast episode. And it sounds like an amazing novel that I hope everybody will pick up and read. It's kind of a true crime novel, but it sounds just so insightful and intuitive. She wrote it to honor her daughter, Haley, who's a member of the LGBTQ family. And she takes an extremely interesting journey in this book called Mount Hope. And I don't even want to spoil it. I will let her share about it. And I hope that you'll listen to the entire episode so that you can find out about her book and where to get it when it's released. There's so much in this conversation, and I had such a great connection with Kelly that I can't wait to share this episode with you. So let's get started and dive right in. Hi, Kelly. Welcome to the podcast. I'm so honored to be having this conversation with you today. And like I told everybody in the introduction, we are both Kansas girls at heart, but neither of us in Kansas anymore, right?
That's right. Hi, Melissa. I'm glad to be here with you. There's something very special about moms who get together and share their hearts together like this. And so I've been looking forward to this. I really have.
Thank you. I have been too. So I'm going to ask you, like I had told you before, to start with your lost story, whatever that means to you.
Thank you. So we adopted Chris when he was 14 years old. And he was our son for 10 years. And at the age of 24, he took his life unexpectedly. We didn't see it coming. And that was hard. As your audience knows, and as you know, he was full of life and excited, and he loved asking questions and making people laugh. And he championed people and championed causes. We adopted him at age 14, but he had a whole life before we got him. And he was at age 3, found drunk, naked, and cut up on the streets of Wichita. And he was put into the foster care system, and lots of things happened to him while he was in foster care. And so by the time we got him, he had experienced a lot of trauma, an unfair amount of trauma. And he came from a DNA tribe that was involved with drugs and alcohol. So he's very susceptible to that. He was successful in high school when we were his parents as a teen, and he got a football scholarship to a college, and was, but after one semester, he couldn't handle the freedom that college afforded someone with those kind of vulnerabilities. And so he then joined the Army, and he did well in the Army until he had money and free time. And it was at that time that he began to entertain just about any kind of drug that he could entertain. And it was a way to chase away all of the trauma that he had experienced. He was in and out of rehab, in and out of jail, in and out of hospitals. And it was sad. And it's hard. It's hard as a parent because you want to say yes to everything. You want to encourage and support and love and say yes to every question that comes across. But when your son is an addict, you have to have boundaries and you have to say no. And, you know, we're there, we're supportive, we're encouraging, but saying no becomes what you have to say when you have someone who can't be trusted with money. So he was doing really well. He was 6 weeks in another halfway house, clean and sober. And we told him that if you can be clean for another 6 months, we're going to bring you out to Colorado and we'll be your support team out here and you can live with us and we will encourage you, but we need to see some success underneath you. And I think your halfway house is the place for that. This is in 2020, summer of 2020, and COVID is in the middle of everything. Black Lives Matter is a huge deal, right? And my husband is a superintendent of schools, and he was preparing for a school year that looked like no other. He was going to have to do hybrid classes. He was going to have to offer Zoom classes and in structured classrooms, and the desks had to be far apart, and they had to have air purifiers and systems in place to keep everybody healthy. And so it was a really busy time for him. The sheriff walked into his office one day and told him that they found Chris and that he had taken his life. And it's hard to share the method of it. And so you can edit out this if you don't feel comfortable with sharing methods on the show with vulnerable survivors and grievers, but he hung himself in an alley. And the police said, we know that he did this and this wasn't a murder because there was a videotape of it. And so we drove back to Wichita and got the remains of our son and brought him home. But here's the thing is my husband and I were on two different tracks of trying to deal with this. He did not have time to grieve. He had to, that day, get back in the planning of getting schools back online, right? He didn't have time to grieve. And I laid in my bed and didn't get up. Now, I'm an author, and I was in the process of finishing my book. And when Chris died, I stopped writing. I stopped playing the guitar. I stopped eating well and walking. I just became, you know, a sad, quiet person who laid down on the bed.
A shell of yourself, right?
Yeah. All creativity was gone. All passion was gone. I couldn't even function. And I know everyone who's listening and who's experienced this understands that place. My husband began to drink, and he would come home from work after being stretched and pulled in all kinds of ways in order to accommodate COVID concerns. And then he'd go outside on the porch and start drinking whiskey. And that was unusual for him. And it scared me a little bit. And so what was happening is we had hit a fork in a road, and I was going left and he was going right. And we were not on the same road anymore. So what happened next was kind of interesting. 6 weeks after Chris passed away, his ashes are on our counter. We haven't had a memorial service for him yet because we're waiting for family from all over the United States to come join us for Christmas. We had told him if he could be stay sober, we would bring him out for Christmas. And this is not how we expected it to go, but we were going to have the memorial service in a few months. And so I get a call from the Ellen DeGeneres show, her game show people. And I had 2 years prior auditioned for her game show. And I
Game of Games, right? Wasn't that what it was called?
That's exactly right. So I'm still on the couch and I'm still not moving, right? And the game show calls and says, hey, we got your audition tape and we would like you to have a conversation with our producers and our casting department. And when I applied for that show, I was a different life. I was back in Kansas. I was in the high school classroom. My students helped me make the videotape for it. And since then, I had moved and I had retired and lost a son. And I was just in a completely different place.
You probably almost forgot that you had done it, right? Did you have a moment where you almost went, what? Who is this calling about what?
I had forgot. And I assumed that because I hadn't heard from them, that I was not considered as a contestant. You know, you just sort of never hear from them. So we'll call you if we want you kind of thing. So not only had I forgot, but I thought that I had been declined, I guess. Mm-hmm. So now I have a decision to make. I am 6 weeks out from Chris's passing. And am I going to get on a game show and pretend to be happy and have joy and express myself freely and authentically? It's like, how is that even possible? I can't even muster a shower today. And so I really wasn't quite sure how I was going to do this, but I saw it as an opportunity that perhaps I should take advantage of. And so I decided to go, and I left my husband behind with his whiskey and decided I was going to go try and find some joy. Now, we were the very first game show production, actually production period, not just game show, on the Warner Brothers set in Los Angeles. And this was after COVID restrictions were lifted. So they were very serious. Everybody was in hazmat, kind of full surgical, shoes covered, gloves, mask, shield, gowns. They were very serious.
Like you had been dropped into a Contagion movie set or something, right?
Yes.
But yet you're going to go laugh. Yeah.
I know. And so they quarantined us for 6 days in a hotel room, and you were in your hotel room by yourself, and you had to stay in there for 6 days. And we had 4 COVID tests before they'd even let us on the set for the first day. And I sat there for that 6 days by myself and decided that what am I going to do? This is the weirdest dichotomy between complete sadness and I got to be a cheerleader now on TV. And so I just decided to look pain right in the face and just lean right into it. Because when I was laying down on the couch at my house, I was actually avoiding it. So I journaled and I prayed and I meditated and I read and I slept and I ate food and practiced talking normal again. And I just really leaned hard into what I was feeling. And what came of that was Chris was my most enthusiastic, congratulatory, celebratory personality. He was like a hype man. He'd be like, yeah, woo-hoo. And so I began to have sort of some sacred imagination around me. It's probably spiritual too, of him celebrating around me being part of this process. Because if he were alive, he totally would be the first and most encouraging one of my kids, right? He would just be so happy and pleased and tickled that I was going to get to play in this manner. And so the first day of the game started, and that's exactly what I did. I said a little prayer. I sort of tried to find, to be grounded, said a prayer, and then imagined him beside me, cheering me on. And I was able then to be genuinely joyful and playful on this show, because every step of the way, he was beside me, encouraging me. And that is exactly who he would be in real life. So long story short, I won. I made it all the way to the very end, and I won $75,000. And I, you know, Twitch is over there celebrating, doing his DJ sort of music dance thing for my win. And Chris would get the biggest kick out of Twitch. And I just felt Chris there with me. So I am flying high as a kite, not only because I won and I did this kind of scary thing and I got to meet Ellen, you know, because that's amazing, but Chris got to do it with me. And I hope is so defiant that I was able to just grab onto hope and hold on to it. And I was like, this works. This worked for me. So I get in the limo afterwards as the winner, and they're going to take me home all by myself, take me to the back to the hotel, because there's only, you know, just a handful of winners left at the end of the season. The hotel's now empty. And I'm trying to call my husband. I'm trying to like, see, where are you? Where are you? I have such good news. I have some things to tell you. And I want to tell the kids too, but I can't until I tell you first. I want to tell you first, where are you? And he's not answering. I get this one little text message from him, said, I'll get to you in just a second. And I'm sort of annoyed because hours are going by and I have all of this emotion and happiness and joy and healing that's happened. And it isn't until I fly home the next day that I find out he was in trouble. He drank too much and got in a car accident and was arrested and got a DUI at the same exact moment I was dancing and playing with our son. And we couldn't have been further apart. And you can't be a superintendent of a school district and this not be news. So it was front page news, superintendent arrested for DUI, put on suspension. Then it's on the Denver, you know, news on TV and Colorado Springs TV. And so it was hard. And so I came home high as high can be. I won. I healed.
Natural high though.
Yes, of course. I'm glad you said that because I do live in Colorado.
Well, and I wasn't even thinking about that, but in talking about the stark contrast between, you know, your husband dealing with a very real substance on the other end of things. And, you know, I was just drawing the comparison to there you were finding such a natural high in the choice and the joy.
Yeah. And then the irony of our addicted son and Steve's becoming someone who is dependent on alcohol, and his actions and choices had consequences that were very public and very embarrassing and painful. And we just couldn't be further apart. We just were on completely two different places. And I had told Ellen on the end of the show that I was going to spend the money on a down payment for our house. And I didn't want to. I became kind of, I had a little, I don't know what the word is, but I didn't want to spend it on that. I wanted it to be mine. I didn't want to spend it on his attorney, any of his legal costs, his diversion, getting his car out of hock. You know, I didn't want to pay any of that. And I didn't want to invest in our home because I was so devastated by where we were because our family's falling apart. So I bought a tombstone for Chris and I bought myself a little used car and I gave the rest away. And I acknowledge that isn't a practical choice because we needed that money. Steve lost his job, but it made me feel good. And it felt like it was mine and I didn't want his choices or action or everything that was wrapped up in that circumstance to rob me of the joy that I had when I did this thing. Cause I worked so hard, right? And just emotionally to be in that place. And so I gave it away to all the students who helped me do the video audition. I gave it to some single mom students that I had worked with for a while, some teachers who also helped me with the production of that, and to my kids. And I have no regrets about that. Was it practical? No. Was it based a little bit on some stubborn, hard feelings?
Probably. Some animosity, for sure. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And so Steve and I found ourselves in completely two different planets. And there was resentment and there was pain. And I lost my joy again because now I was like, look what you did to me. I was doing so well and I was ready to take you with me. And look what you did. And so there was blaming and shaming. And of course, my husband can't heal under those circumstances either. And so, you know, we had to find our way out or we were going to have to go our own way. This is the kind of thing that breaks families up. This is the kind of thing that people don't recover from unless you're very intentional about it. And that's where we landed is that, okay, we're both dealing with this in our own ways. And we're both hurting and maybe we can figure this out together. And so there was a path that we built for ourselves and it started with faith. It started with, well, I'm going to lean into the Lord and you lean into the Lord. And I think that's where we need to begin. And so that was intentional, of course. And then we started therapy separately. We did not go to therapy together.
Was that your idea or was that suggested to you? I'm just kidding.
I forced it on him.
You said, I'm going to do this by myself first.
Yeah. And he was mandated to do it because of had qualified for a diversion and the court said, you're going to have to go to counseling. But he started counseling before it was mandated. And I said, you've got to be able to figure out how to deal with your feelings because you were running away from them. And that's why all of this happened. And so you've got to find a way to help do that in a healthy way. So we both went to therapy separately. We both leaned into our faith. Now, I'm not going to say our faith community was very silent about everything, not only Chris's death, but then all the headlines about Steve's situation. And so it's not a faith community we were leaning into. We're talking a one-on-one God and me. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And we had to create a safe space where we could communicate with each other and it not be full of shame and blame. And so we got to express what we were feeling, but we could not hurt the other person in the process. So we made some rules for ourselves to do that. And then lastly, Steve lost his job and the practical gets real practical and real obvious. We've got to figure out a way to make money and make a house payment and pay our bills. And so we started a nonprofit together. And this was kind of the last part of our healing was to do this thing together that was not associated with Chris, that was not associated with the DUI or Ellen even. It had to be sort of something separate we could both pour our hearts into. And so we created a nonprofit that supports and loves on teachers. And we hold retreats for them in the summertime. And so that was our healing path. But we had to be really intentional about it because we were on two different planets. It was not going to come together. We were, the planes were going down on both sides. So sometimes when you lose someone, especially in suicide, because you're already in the blaming and shaming game, right? All of the what ifs and should haves that parents feel, it's a trap and we know it. But we go there. Our mm-hmm. natural minds walk right into that trap. And that's really hard. And so when we began to do it to each other, there was just no way we were going to get through it without being really intentional about it. So as believers, you know, we have hope and assurance that Chris is in a better place and that we're going to get to see him someday. And now as husband and wife, we have hope that we can move forward now from a place of dealing with our emotions very honestly and authentically and not throwing the other one under the bus. So it's been a crazy journey. And I don't know if other couples experience this kind of diverse path of mourning and healing, but it's painful. But I think we're richer on the other side of it. I think we're closer on the other side of it. And it's probably the way we should have started when it first happened, but we didn't. We were just drowning and trying to survive.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, so often, you know, in everything in life, we feel like hindsight's so much clearer, but you didn't have the ability to see it at the time. So,
right.
You know, so much of what you say, I think about the duality of the unrealness of losing a child to suicide, and you're living in such a surreal situation already with, you know, your son has died so tragically and unexpectedly. Your husband's trying to get ready for a life that, let's face it, what educators had to be preparing for in that first year, most of us don't understand other than to think that had to be unbelievable. So he's already in a surreal environment in a global world pandemic, right? That hasn't occurred in our lives before. And then he's thrust into the surreal environment of my child is gone in such a tragic, complicated way. And for you to talk about the choices that you had to make, especially when an opportunity presented itself and you chose to lean into that pain in order to find your power, essentially, and to be faced with the fact that he wasn't in the same place as you were at the same moment, which is, I think, what I can tell you a lot of couples would echo, even if they can't echo the exact same circumstances or timeline. A lot of couples I've heard that are that lost their child, my husband was not my son's father. He did never raise him in our home. So I had the unique ability to have my husband as my support and not have him, to not say he wasn't grieving. He was. He had gotten to know Alec. He cared about him deeply, but he was not his parent. So I had I don't even know what you want to call it. For me, it was the fortune of having a rock that wasn't also being drugged down himself. He was.
Yeah, perfectly said.
Mm-hmm. But so many parents that I talked to that lost their child, that they were living together, married, and that was their child, experience an extreme difficult time. And as you know, the statistics are stacked against not just suicide loss. Child loss in general is one of the main things that can ruin a marriage. And the fact that you and your husband were able to get to a point that you were able to find the hope together, even if you couldn't see the way out together, even if you couldn't see the fact that you could start the journey towards hope. And I mean, I talk about this a lot because even as you were talking, I thought this is in line with a lot of what I talk about, which is we go from survival, we find hope, and then from hope, we can move toward healing. And what you're talking about, and the whole reason I talk about that isn't because I learned it in a book. It's because I lived it just like you. I lived surviving. I lived having to find something that gave me hope that allowed me to say, I have choices to make here. And one of the choices is that we can sometimes say, I don't want to get up, or we can say, I do want to get up. Right. And so to make a choice and then to be experiencing that alongside of another human being who is doing it in their very own way. Mm-hmm. Those don't always align. And so I commend you. I have a couple of questions as you were talking that came to mind. One of them is, you know, to hear you tell the story in, you know, 20 minutes, it sounds like you kind of, this was such a, I don't want to use the word quick journey, but you lost Chris almost 2-year mark. And so,
right.
To hear you talk, I know that this didn't occur in 20 minutes of your life. This took some real work. This took a couple of, because you were on the Ellen Show, within less than 2 months after losing Chris.
Right.
So then you came home immediately to the battle at your home front to save your marriage, to save your family, to be a support, to be there for yourself and to decide how that was going to work for your husband and your marriage. And so you spent the last 2 years rebuilding and figuring this out.
Yeah. And it wasn't always pretty, you know, it was ugly sometimes. And, you know, when I said that I started out, you know, not showering and not writing and not playing the guitar and not just getting off the couch, that is that's avoidance behavior. That's me not really wanting to deal with life. I didn't want to talk about it. I don't want to feel. I'm going to lay as still as possible and try and sleep my way through this pain. It's avoidance. It wasn't looking at the pain. It sort of, from the outside looking in, it might look like that.
Well, because you have to feel to heal. And people, that sounds like such a platitude, but it's true. You have to be willing to go in there and feel it. And that sucks. And that's hard. And so we do avoid that at one point, right? Until we realize that we don't want to become part of the couch.
Right. It looks like mourning, but it actually was avoidance. It was exactly the same thing that Steve was doing by drinking whiskey. He was avoiding, I was avoiding, I was sitting really still trying not to feel, right? So while I'm not going to say the game show healed me and that I was cured after that or, you know, completely over anything, it was just, it gave me a snapshot that I could have this pain and also live life fully if I face the pain, right? And so there was a lot of crying in that hotel room. And so when I came home, it wasn't that I was all better. It was that I knew that we could do this. I had hope again. And I wanted to link arms with my family because Chris's siblings were hurting too. All of us felt so much guilt that we didn't step in and do something, right? And so we were all hurting. And I came home. It wasn't necessarily that I was healed. I came home and I was like, I can lift my family out of this now. I can help them face it, right? I can get off the couch. And so I had hope. And so when I learned that Steve was not in a place of receiving that hope, he was in a completely different place. That's when I sort of had the air knocked out of me again, right? Because I was like, well, wait a minute. I was ready to sort of begin to breathe life back into all of our lungs again. And it was naive, but that's where I was. So then it got ugly again. And that's when I said shame and blame. I said some ugly things to my husband and he was so full of shame. He could hardly even look at me, right? Because he just took all of the harsh things that I said and all the ugly that came out of me. And so, yeah, it's only been 2 years, but it feels like 10 because we avoided, we hoped, then we tanked, and then we blamed and hurt each other even more. And we were embarrassed and very isolated. And I think that's why your podcast is so important, not only to your audience, but to the potential audience out there too, is that your friends and your faith community and your colleagues, they don't know what to say. So they don't say anything. And you're sitting in a place of isolation. You're sitting on an island all by yourself. And so now you have resentment because nobody's acknowledging this great big giant thing that happened to you. And so that makes all of the uglier too, because you're all by yourselves. So you don't have somebody to vent to. And so I love what you're doing and what you're offering to, you know, survivors and grievers out there, because we do feel really isolated. And it's just simply because our friends in the world doesn't know how to deal with this. So they avoid talking about it and they avoid talking about the person you lost, which is all you want to do is talk about them. So this feels like 10 years. It really does. And we're not done. You know, as we're filming this, it's Memorial Day weekend, and we went to the gravesite and laid a football and some flowers for him. And that was hard, but it was also beautiful. And so we're trying to figure out what the world looks like without Chris in it. And we have to revisit pain every once in a while, but there seems to be some special accommodation for people who have experienced that kind of loss, their heart, you know, the heart space. The grief and the loss is still there. It's still the same size, but your heart space has grown to accommodate more of the other good stuff. And so I can't really explain it, except that I want to encourage people to have hope that it's ugly and it's messy, and have grace and mercy for yourself and for your loved ones. Get some help, but don't give up. And there's hope on the other side of that. And it looks different. It doesn't look like the way it used to. And it still hurts every once in a while, but it's worth holding on to.
Yeah.
It's kind of where I've landed. And so boy, 2 years seems like nothing.
I was going to say very well said for whatever that means. And I understand the duality of that time and space thing. You know, it's like we've entered a time and space continuum that doesn't make sense, because all of the time, every griever that mm-hmm. I talk to says it feels like yesterday and it feels like 10 years ago, or it feels like yesterday yeah. and it feels like an eternity all at once. And so there's no such thing as saying it's only been 2 years, because you could also say it's only been 2 years.
That's right. But I've seen people spend the rest of their life laying on the couch, trying to be as still as possible and not feel. And that's hard. That's hard. Oh, man. That breaks my heart.
It breaks mine too, because there is still a whole life out there, and there is still, so, you know, to hear that, you know, Ellen's show just was the opportunity that presented itself. It could have been something else. And in most of our lives, it was something else. But Ellen's show presented such a unique opportunity because it allowed you that time and space to, you know, you gave yourself space and grace, is what I often call it. And you allowed Chris to come alongside of you. You allowed him in, it sounds like, for the first time, instead of being alone on the couch in the quiet space, just with a bubble around you, not wanting to absorb any of it. You allowed him to come alongside of you and experience joy again, which then gave you the hope, right? Because you came home remembering what it felt like to be happy, and you remembered your beautiful, vibrant son. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing, I've borrowed a phrase that a lot of my grievers hang on to, and I always remind them, it's not mine, I just don't know the author. But when we get to this place, it's because we've decided we want to live in the light of their life instead of the shadow of their death. And that can beautiful. Be a really, it is beautiful and it's meaningful. And for me, that's exactly how I felt when I had to make a decision, a choice to really live life again and participate. And I often say I spent, my husband and I literally and figuratively set out on life to chase joy. When we sold our home and businesses and went and bought a big motor home and decided to travel, I told people I stripped my life back down to nothing. And I decided I didn't know where joy was, joy and hope, but that I was going to chase it until I found it. And somewhere out there, that's what happened, right? Somewhere out there, someday I'll tell more of my personal story, but that's what happened, is I allowed myself the space and the grace and allowed my son back in. Mm-hmm. And found the joy, let the hope sink in, and then I started to heal from there. And like you said, it doesn't mean that those bad days never come and that it isn't still hard, because it is. But I now know that it's not going to swallow me whole.
Beautifully said. It's scary to, you know, when you are on that couch trying not to feel, and then you invite Chris's memory back in, because you know it's a delight, but it's also, I miss you so much, right? And so you have to feel both of those things. And it's a very courageous act to sit and be intentional about, I want all the memories right now in their fullness. I want to feel in that sort of sacred imagination. I want to give you permission to be present right now. And that is scary, because it both hurts and it both is a delight. And then you begin to crave other people. We just talk about Chris. You know, if you want to give me a gift, talk about my son. Quit avoiding talking about him, because I love talking about him now. Is there still a little pain associated with that? Of course there is, because I miss him. But it's a huge act of courage to sit there and invite all of the good in, because you know it's going to hurt. But you're right. I don't know how I'm going to get back to joy, but it involves inviting those memories in. It starts there. And there's a whole lot of courage in that.
There is. And it starts with, you said something that made me think about, you said right now, which what that means is to me, it involves just today in this moment. And I think a lot of times when we're in deep sorrow, we can get overwhelmed with the idea of how am I ever, and we're looking at our whole life right there in front of us, how am I ever going to live my life again without our child? We see this vastness in front of us instead of just stopping and going right now. Right now, I'm going to experience joy. And right now, I'm going to figure out what this looks like for my family. And it made me think of somebody recently, a grieving mom that reached out and said when she started this journey toward hope, when she found hope and started the getting out of bed, started that part that somebody imparted on her to just think about today. It's kind of what works for think about 12-step programs and things like that. Don't think about what tomorrow or Christmas or next year or all those things are going to look like. Think about today. And it impacted her so much that every day she woke up, she said, all I have to do is worry about today. And she ended up having a beautiful printed today word and framed it in a really pretty frame. And it sits on her bedside stand. So that every day when she wakes up now, the first thing she sees is today, and it brings her a sense of calm. And I'm sure that doesn't mean she doesn't now probably have, you know, plans beyond today in her world.
Right.
But there's something grounding in realizing we don't have to take the weight of things that haven't occurred yet onto our shoulders right now. That right now we just need to. And so you saying right now I have to do this, when you said, you know, that just really made me think about the griever that's listening to you and I talk and thinking, yeah, but my whole life, or how am I ever going to? Don't think about ever, just think about starting right now.
Right. Yeah. Very good point, because we don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. And I think that I had said earlier that hope is a defiant act, and that people who experience hope and understand and lean into hope first have experienced hopelessness and have first experienced the opposite side of that coin. And, you know, there's almost a part of me that thinks that if your life is all well and good and you haven't experienced trauma or tragedy, do you experience hope in the same way that someone else who has had those awful experiences does? I don't know. But I think I think hope is something worth reaching for. And ironically, after, you know, my husband and I had kind of worked through our individual issues and decided to come alongside each other and link arms again, I then began to write again. And ironically, my book that I picked back up again is called Mount Hope. And so I'm going to give you a brief description of it, because if you don't mind, at the end of the book, I included Chris. I included my boy, and with a really intentional purpose behind that. So I'll give you a little background on my book. It's a fiction book. It took me 7 years to complete, by the way, but it was my gift and my love letter to the LGBTQ plus community. I've been an ally and an advocate of theirs for a very long time. I have a transgender daughter. And what I have discovered and understood personally too, is that there is a crisis of faith that happens when you realize that your identity or your sexuality does not seem to coexist with Christianity or other faith religions too. But sadly, Christianity has become the weapon of choice to sort of marginalize and discriminate against this group of people. And so I wanted to entertain the idea that what if Jesus himself could communicate to the world and say, look, I don't have a problem with your sexuality or your identity. I just want a relationship with you. I don't care how you decorate your locker. I care how you walk with me in the hallways. And so that's sort of where it came from, because I realized that people I loved were having crises of faith when they hit the wall of like, well, I love the Lord, but I also have to be true to who I am. So that leads them to a place of being really stuck and consider suicide for themselves. So this fiction story is a hate crime, a horrible hate crime that happens in Topeka, Kansas. Topeka is the real life center of the hate group Westboro Baptist Church. They're the ones who protest funerals and have really ugly signs and have been around for a very long time. And so this hate crime happens in Topeka, Kansas, and there's an investigation, and it actually involves the Westboro Baptist Church folks. But there's also a second plot line where the young murdered man and Jesus have a conversation in Mount Hope Cemetery about being gay and about a relationship with him. And so at the very end of the book, not only is the murder solved and Jesus and the victim get to have this conversation that they hope will change the world and soften hearts and encourage those who want a relationship with God to just lean into it, they go to heaven, right? So there's the last scene in the book is David is the name of the victim and Jesus see a crowd before them. And I put Chris in that crowd. And in that crowd, there are everybody's pets, animals and cats and dogs and all kinds of pets that are waiting for their owners to come into heaven. And Chris was the caretaker of the pet of David, the murdered victim. And so he says, who is this man? And I describe him and he looks like Chris in the story. And he said, oh, he took care of Murray, your dog, until you got here. And it's just a quiet little reference to Chris, but putting him in a story about hope and knowing that he is there and healed and whole and waiting for us was cathartic to me and was absolute medicine to my soul and to my family. I'm writing about heaven and this blissful, healed place. And there he is, young and beautiful and whole and healed and not addicted and not lost. And so I actually wrote a blog about him too. It was like, who is Chris on page 367? And it was healing for me to put him in there. It was not intent. I mean, it wasn't part of the plan when I put the book down and couldn't write anymore, but it sure was organic to write him into that scene. And so my book comes out at the end of June. And again, it's really for my LGBTQ plus and the possible Pharisees that might soften their hearts about the idea of including them in the kingdom of heaven. But Chris is there. And that was part of my journey too, is to put him into this creative space of mine. You know, when I lost him, I lost my creativity. I had no passion, like I said. And so when I got that back, I wanted to honor him. And that was nice. You know, there are people who write poetry and songs and paint and express themselves in all kinds of creative ways. And if you can do that for the one you lost, that it helped. It really did.
Yeah, I did an episode not too long ago, a rabbit hole episode about I don't even know exactly what it was titled now, but it was about the fact that I believe finding a creative outlet it's not medical fact, but me giving my opinion is that I do feel it's necessary as healing, as someone who needs to heal from, you know, when you're trying to heal from a trauma that's super extreme, I feel like finding a creative outlet of some sort is undoubtedly going to come along at some point. I feel like that looks different for everybody. Like you said, for some people it's song, for some people it's doing something very public, other people it's making a private garden and picking up a new hobby. I mean, but there is true healing in the creativity that comes, you know, out of us when we're able to, because what it's doing is, and you put it so nicely when you talked about sitting on the couch versus, you know, that you just, it's getting it out versus keeping it in.
Yeah.
And a creative outlet of any sort. I happened to podcast. I had no idea. I knew why I wanted to podcast, but I didn't give it enough credit for being one of those creative outlets, because it is driven from my heart and it is me wanting to provide hope and ways and all the things for people to survive this. And there's a selfish element to it as well. I mean, it's healing for me. And so, you know, I would be completely not truthful if I said this is a completely selfless act. I don't think any of us in our creativity are doing it completely selflessly. We are somewhat intentionally healing ourselves as well.
I agree. And there's also just a sense of being proud of yourself for doing it. You know, it's like, that was good for you, Kelly. Good job. But like I said, I think hope is one of those things that is just sitting there waiting for you to grab onto. We just have to be kind of intentional about it. My book, ironically being called Mount Hope, is giving a message of hope to LGBTQ plus people who want a relationship with Jesus. But it's also you know, giving hope to anybody who feels really stuck and like they are stuck in their circumstances and there's yeah. no way out. And also, you know, there's an old belief system about suicide that they don't get to go to heaven. And I don't know where that came from, but I had an 83-year-old woman say that to my face, and I forgave her right away because I knew it came from a place of ignorance. But she literally, I told her that I lost my son, and she goes, "Oh, that's too bad. He's not going to be able to go to heaven." And I said, "I don't believe that. I know for a fact that he's there. I've been reassured of that. I know that in my heart." And she knew not to argue with me, but putting Chris in the heaven scene was also a defiant form of hope too. It was my way of saying, I don't believe that old set of rules. Whoever made up that rule, I don't believe it. It's not right. I don't even like saying committed suicide anymore, because committed is attached to sin. You've committed a sin, you know? And so I am just stubborn enough that I want to infect the world with hope about this.
Yeah, me too. And I'm right there with
it comes from a place of stubbornness and defiance, but also optimism. And I'm encouraged by the people that I meet, and I'm encouraged by people like yourself who so beautifully and articulately navigate people through their pain and help them see that they're not alone, because it was isolation that probably took, you know, our loved one's life, and it's isolation that we sit in when we're grieving from it. And so what you're doing is so powerful. I'm really proud of you, but you're also doing it so beautifully. You're doing it well. And you're right. This is your creative outlet. You're very gifted at it.
Oh, thank you. It's mutual, because I look at you and being a writer and just think that's amazing that you were able to pick that up. And I love that you're a fiction writer. And I can't wait to have a physical copy of your book in my hands, because I love a physical book. I know you were generous and gifted me a copy to read, and I started to skim through it and thought, I just want the book.
I love bookmarks and
turning pages and love the physical aspect of that. And for some of my listeners, it probably sounds like a strange duality. I am not a woman of faith. I am a very spiritual person, and I know that I'll see my son again someday. And what I have come to understand in my own journey is that, and I have acceptance and love for people of all faiths and all belief systems. I feel like a lot of times we're coming at the same thing from a different place is all we're doing. At the end of the day, it's a matter of what we call it and how we see it, but the end result for me feels the same. So to hear you talk about your faith is of no confront to me, it feels comforting, not confronting. And it's too bad in this world that too many people take somebody else's belief system and feel confronted by it. And it just, again, I think all of us need to find the comfort and the hope and the belief in something, whatever that looks like for us. And so I'm excited to read it and read your message. And any way anybody can impart hope in this world, I'm all for that. And I love that I would love nothing more than to feel like it's going to land in some of the places and soften hearts that you would hope it would. Some of the hate that's out there.
Yeah.
I have no doubt it's going to have an effect on many more people that you probably didn't even have any idea you were going to affect. So
Thank you. I love how you said that. And I just think that because you're a spiritual person, you know, in your core, a knowing, you're right. There's just a knowing in you about you're going to see your son someday.
Yeah,
and there's something on the other side of this. And that, again, is a defiant form of hope. I can't see it. I can't explain it. I can't predict it, but I have hope. And there's just so many gatekeepers and in terms of faith, and this is certainly could be a whole nother podcast, so many gatekeepers keeping people from experiencing their version of God. You know, the same gatekeepers that would keep an LGBTQ plus person out of the kingdom is the same person who would have kept Chris out.
Right.
And so, sorry, I don't buy it.
Right.
That's not what my knowing tells me. So me thank you either. For sharing that. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no, I appreciate it. And I love your message. I don't love the reason that you have this message to share. Mm-hmm. But I love your message.
I don't either. Thank you. Thank you.
I want to make sure that I will point people to any places you want me to, all of the places we've talked about and things that we've talked about in the show notes. But if verbally you can point them to one place that you would want somebody to land, that they can find all the things that Kelly Wolf and what she's doing is about, where would that be?
Well, there happens to be one place. It happens to be kellywolf.com. My first name is spelled K-E-L-I-E. My last name is Wolf, like the animal, only with two O's. So W-O-O-L-F. And that's where you'll find blog posts about Chris and about faith and about gatekeepers and my book. And so that's sort of all things there. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm making this all up as I go. And so I'm sort of
say that all the time. So I'm right there with you. I'm like, I'm just doing this as it comes. I always say I'm doing this organically, which is just a fancy way of saying I'm flying by the seat of my pants like the rest of us.
And I'm
figuring this out as Alex lets me know what the next move is going to be.
I love that. I love that. And so, yeah, I can't. So yes, I am attempting to have a small voice in the world. And so if you're interested in my book, you can go to my website and it'll take you right over to Amazon where you can order it. I have a Kindle version and a soft cover version and the hard cover version, which is beautiful. And I'm going to make sure, Melissa, you get a copy of that hardcover because I'm so proud of it.
But signed, please.
of course, you got it, sister. And so, yeah. kellywolf.com, or you can just search for Mount Hope Kelly Wolf on Amazon and you'll find my book there. But I also sit in grieving and suicide survivors and parents of suicide groups because I'm still holding and linking arms with people who are experiencing this loss. And so don't be afraid to find me on Facebook too. You might find me in that private group where we're talking about how to hold on to our memories and heal at the same time. So yeah, find me. I'd love to link arms with you.
Yeah. Yeah. I will put all the places where people can do that. And is there anything you haven't shared that you'd like to share? And if not, wrap us up with one more nugget of hope.
No pressure, by the way.
Right.
I feel so much love for this grieving community. And it's never been on my radar before, you know, until you are in it and a member of it, reluctant member of it, you don't really realize that there's this group of people who are sort of unheard and unseen and trying the best they can. And because shows like yours and people who have written healing books and people who have linked arms with me and helped me stand back up, I have nothing but love and compassion and just generosity and appreciation for the people who saw me in my pain and because they were experiencing it too. It's just, we're a unique little club of people. And every time I run into a mom who's lost a child, it is a sweet kind of reunion. It is not full of pain all the time. Sometimes it's just a sweet recognition, this sweet knowing of we've been there, haven't we? And so your tribe is out there. Your people are out there. And I know it may feel like you're isolated right now because the ones you were counting on have remained silent, but there are people out there ready to just wrap you in their arms. So open your eyes to it and get up off the couch.
So well said. So until we connect again, because I know we will, we'll talk soon. Thanks so much, Kelly.
Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Grievers, it is my hope that from today, you will take that which serves you and simply leave the rest. I would love to connect with you. And the best way to do that is to start out on my website, where the first thing you'll find is a video recorded message from me. And then from there, you can find everything I offer. The online Zoom support groups, the books I've written, ways to connect for the podcast, and an entire resource library assembled to help all suicide loss grievers find the resources that they need to help them along their healing journey. Please go to theleftoverpieces.com. From there, I hope that we can connect, and I hope that you too can discover that we truly are better together. If anything that you've heard in today's episode resonates with you, I would ask that you please subscribe to get notified every week of my new episodes. And then take a moment to rate and review me on Apple Podcasts so that more grievers like us can find this podcast and this community. It is from my own experience of finding myself sitting amid the leftover pieces of my own shattered heart that I can tell you that while it seems impossible in the early days, it is possible to put those pieces back together and be okay again. And every week, we'll be right here providing more comfort, hope, and community. So until next week, I'll sign off today with some words from one of my Alex's favorites, Peter Pan. Never say goodbye, because goodbye means going away, and going away means forgetting. Grievers, no one here is forgetting. Talk soon.